The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Krotowski, on this week's show.
I was just trying to find someone who could imitate Danny Wallace. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do that, I might as well give it a go. So I managed to find his email address on some slightly creepy fan site. And I sent it to him and just assumed that I'd never hear back from him again. That was it done. And I think it was about 20 minutes later, I got a, yeah, that's great, let's do it.
Creator of hit indie game Thomas Was Alone, Mike Bithell discusses the intricacies of creating a compelling narrative-driven game and why writer and actor Danny Wallace was key to its success. Also, I'll be joined by the tech team, the amazing tech team, to discuss Google's purchase of the gaming streaming service Twitch, why the rise of the phablet poses a problem for Apple, and the implications for the web browser now that the right to be forgotten has a basis in law. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Joining me this week is Charles Arthur. Hello, Charles.
Hello.
Keith Stewart. Hello, Keith.
Hello.
And Samuel Gibbs. Hi, Sam.
Hello. Yeah,
Sam, I need to deal with this. Do you want to be called Sam or Samuel? I know that there's a professional distinction.
I don't mind.
I'll call you Samuel, just to be consistent.
Okay.
Right. But if you call me Alexandra, it'll freak me out. It'll make me feel like you're my mother or something like that, which is not a problem. I love my mother, but still. Keith, I'm going to kick off with you. It was reported this week that Google is in talks to purchase Twitch for a cool $1 billion. And we have to say that with our little pinkies in our mouths.
$1 billion.
What is Twitch? And you know what? I'm sure we've heard of them before on this program.
Yeah, Twitch is essentially a live streaming platform for video games. So it's people who either want to watch esports on the internet, so that can be live streamed to them from many of the events that go on around the world based around games like Dota 2 and League of Legends. But it also allows users to, with a webcam on their PC or attached to their consoles, to stream game content live over the net. So if they're playing a game of Call of Duty and want everyone else to see them playing it and commenting on it, they can do that via Twitch.
And how does this not devolve into the sort of the great horror of blue air between the ears on something like Xbox Live?
Well, it's different in that you're effectively broadcasting to an audience, so you are an entertainer. It's a similar model, I guess, to YouTube superstars like PewDiePie and Syndicate, who are actually both active on Twitch as well. And so it's you broadcasting yourself as much as the game. So you get people doing like amazing speed runs of games. You get people analyzing and giving tips and tactics on new titles. So it's not really kind of a multiplayer feel to it, although there is a chat window on Twitch. So one of the things that people love about Twitch is that they can get involved with the broadcast. If someone's broadcasting a really interesting video of, say, Uncharted, people can get involved with the chat window, talk to the presenter and talk to each other and discuss it. So it's got a kind of community feel.
But in addition, the reason that we've heard about Twitch before is from a phenomenon called Twitch Plays Pokemon. What was that? And Samuel, we talked about this before, didn't we?
It was democracy playing games, effectively. But they hooked up an emulator for Pokemon, and it was anybody in the chat window could control what was happening on the screen. So, of course, everybody was controlling what was happening on the screen. And you had literally thousands of people trying to get from one side of the map to the other, each going like, go left, go left, go left, up, up, up. And, of course, there was the odd person who went down and then screwed the whole lot up. It was a phenomenon. I had no idea that this kind of thing would be entertaining enough to captivate thousands of people at any one time.
For quite a while as well, wasn't it?
Day and night.
Yeah. It's still going on. They're working their way through the Pokemon series, I think, so it's still going. But I think what Twitch Plays Pokemon showed was that Twitch has a kind of a culture all of its own. It has its own language, it has its own slang, it has its own in-jokes. So Twitch plays Pokemon really symbolized that sense of culture and community that exists within Twitch, and that people are worried that if Google does take over, does buy Twitch, which is by no means assured definitely yet, that, you know, the money hasn't exchanged hands, but if it happens, then will that sense of culture be somehow lost and diluted within the, you know, the mammoth infrastructure of Google and YouTube?
Before we dive into that question, because it's obviously a very interesting question and very passionate for those people who are involved, Keith, Google has bought a video streaming service about computer games. What? Why?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons, really. Google does do live streaming, but it hasn't. It's not the focus of its business, really, and it hasn't really reached its potential as that. Whereas live streaming is what Twitch TV is all about. Twitch has a platform which isn't amazing, but it works. It's efficient. So there's a desirability there in terms of technology. YouTube hasn't done live streaming very well. Twitch does it very well. It has an audience, has an established audience, a very big audience, 45 million users. So that's desirable in itself. Plus, it's the kind of people that Twitch talks to. Twitch is essentially dominated by males in the 18 to sort of 30 category. This is a demographic which is getting harder and harder for traditional advertisers to reach. Like, it's very difficult to reach these people through television. It's very difficult to reach them through music. They're not using the established channels that advertisers are used to. Twitch is a great way to get to those people. So obviously there's an advertising element to this as well.
Sam.
And so from the Twitch side of things, if you're looking at why Google, Twitch needs infrastructure. And Google provides a lot of infrastructure, provides flexibility, provides something that it would take a lot of money to get Twitch going. And reportedly, and again, not confirmed, they rejected purchase from Microsoft and many others just wanting to effectively give money, which is not what they wanted.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're struggling. I think they're a small company and the Twitch has grown enormously. I mean, it's doubled its audience in the last, you know, a year. So it's grown enormously, and they don't have the capacity, I don't think, to deal with it in terms of the number of developers they have, the number of staff they have. They cannot cope with the sheer demand for their service. So yeah, Google does offer that to them.
Well, that's what they offer. But Charles, what does Twitch offer to Google? Keith mentioned this idea of the streaming service. YouTube hasn't been able really to, that hasn't taken a foothold in YouTube's canon. What is it, how is it that this would fit within Google Inc.?
It brings a really engaged audience, people who will spend hours and hours watching stuff. It's sort of like if it were, the best description I've seen of this is it's rather as if it bought a sports channel. You know, basically, you know, with sort of sports news, you know, if it was to buy a channel that showed basketball all the time and that showed cricket all the time and all that sort of stuff. So, it's like getting really, really engaged people. It's just that they happen to like watching video games rather than sports games.
And does this fit within their idea about Google TV as well?
It's possible that they could use it to sort of promote a console. There's been rumours about an Android Google console, games console coming out. It certainly fits into all the sorts of things of Google wanting to have very engaged people who they can show adverts to and, just picking up attention from people wherever they can. Yeah, that's really what it's about, is intensifying the levels of attention they get from people, because someone who just comes along, does a search, goes away, that's not much use to Google. Somebody who spends hours looking at a screen, that's their ideal sort of customer.
Keith, final word on this.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the engagement, I mean, there's some amazing numbers around Twitch and the fact that it is the most popular way of watching esports. I mean, over 70 million people last year watching esports regularly. Twitch TV, 2.4 billion hours of gameplay was watched on Twitch TV in 2013. So these are people that kind of live, breathe, and eat video in video games. According to Wall Street Journal, Twitch was the fourth biggest source of internet traffic in the US, behind Google, Apple, and Netflix last year. So these are kind of enormous numbers. So it's little wonder really that Google and Microsoft are both showing interest.
Well, you can read The Guardian's coverage of Twitch and hear our previous coverage of Twitch Plays Pokemon at theguardian.com/technology. Now, it may only be a matter of an inch. We do Imperial here in the UK, of course, but according to the latest research from Canalys, one third of all smartphones sold in the first quarter of this year were 5-inch plus phones, or phablets, as they've become known. Sam, how do phablets, apart from their size, actually differ from regular smartphones?
Well, it is primarily about size. I mean, the first factor is a bigger screen. Not necessarily device size, but the bigger screen. And a phablet, by certain people's definition, is anything over 5 inches. And it originally started with the idea that these 5-inch plus phones often came with a stylus, and that's where Samsung really cemented itself. Its phablets had a stylus, like the Note series, and so it was more of an all-doing, all-singing, all-dancing device that you could sketch on, tap away, etc., etc. It was much more than the phone. But it's really become essentially a large phone, often ridiculously sized phone.
So it's kind of going the opposite direction of what was predicted in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure 2.
It very much is. It's like it's the old adage of the bigger it is, the better it is, the more powerful, the more you can do with it, and the more you look like a complete numpty trying to make a phone call on it. But of course, people don't make many phone calls these days, so it's more about using the device as a data device.
So why are they big in Asia and not here?
Well, they're bigger in Asia generally because the Asian market is much more about consuming large amounts of media and things like that on their smartphones, and the bigger the screen size, the more media you can get. There's two ways to look at the phablet. There's the productive phablet, which is the all singing, all dancing, many multitasking features and whatnot, and then there's the media consumption phablet, which doesn't necessarily, isn't as powerful, is cheaper, but with a big screen. And so the Asian market, they tick both boxes. But of course, when we look in, say, like the US or European market, very much more about carrying the phone on your person in a pocket, whereas the Asian market really isn't. That it's often in a bag.
So it doesn't have anything to do with spectrum or the speed or anything like that. I mean, that has always been an issue when it comes to the type of media that we're consuming in Europe. Have we reached parity?
Yes and no. Depends who you believe, actually. In the UK, on 4G terms, if you believe EE, which has been voted the fastest network by independent adjudicators, we are catching up with them. South Korea still more or less leads the way on the fastest infrastructure, and that's generally because their entire country is fiber, which means everything is connected to fiber, so the wireless speeds can be faster because the base stations are connected to a faster backbone. But in the UK, we're really going for it. Since the launch of 4G here, which was late, there's no two ways about it, we've been ramping up, and the speeds are good. We're currently looking at what EE calls double speed 4G, which is, you know, 30 megabits plus. But there's no reason we can't be hitting 150 megabits in the next 3 years, which they is currently deployed in Tech City area in London, and is due for expansion anytime now.
Yet, when we're talking about phablets, we're not talking necessarily about Apple products. In fact, we're talking very much about other products. Who are the leaders in these fields?
So, yes, that's right. Apple's steadfastly stuck to its iPhone and iPad style, so there's nothing in between. You could almost argue that the iPad Mini is getting to phablet size, considering
phablets are coming up to meet the iPad Mini, I think.
Indeed, yeah.
I mean, there's even a rumour that there'll be a new Samsung phone, which will be 7 inches, of, you know, diagonally measured. Oh, so, yeah. You know, I mean, ta-da, the two come together.
It's going to be Dom Jolly style, trigger-happy TV. But yes, so Samsung is pretty much the dominant market leader, especially in Europe, when it comes to phablets. Its Note series, which more or less kicked it off for the mass market, still dominates. When somebody asks somebody on the street, what's a phablet? It's normally a Note. There are others, of course. Sony's got a 6.44-inch, which is really pushing it, Xperia Z Ultra. LG's got some phablets,
The HTC Max, which I think also had a fingerprint reader on the back.
It did. And,
which
and
for some reason they haven't decided to hang on to with the smaller HTC One M8. Well, I mean, it's all very, you know, it's not as if suddenly something magically happens at 5 inches. You know, a lot of phones are 4.7 inches, 4.9 inches, you know. And the sort of the use of the 5-inch thing, I think, was just a way of, it was an easy way to distinguish them. And I think it was IDC and Gartner, who actually had slightly different. I think Gartner used to say it was 5.5 inches and an IDC said it was 5. And, you know, there's no magic number at which suddenly it becomes, it's a phablet now.
Now, Charles, you wrote an article about this on the Guardian site this week. And in fact, you made a connection between this trend that we're talking about here and the patent wars between Apple and Samsung. Why? What is the relationship?
So there was an interesting presentation that was presented in the Apple versus Samsung patent trial, the second one that concluded in California a few weeks ago. Which Samsung was able to get via the discovery process, where it was an internal presentation. My reliable sources tell me it was a sales presentation at Apple where they were saying, people want what we don't have, which is things like big screens. And it's quite interesting that there is this growing trend, the number of these large, sort of 5-inch and above screens is going up quite dramatically, as Canalys is showing. So Apple essentially has to get onto this bandwagon, or else it's going to be left behind. The feeling is that you have to have something that people will want at this large size, because it's just the evolution. It's just the way that the phones are going.
It is important to note that of all the flagship phones that were launched that are not necessarily deemed as phablets by the manufacturers, they were all 5 inches and above. We're talking the HTC One M8, the Samsung Galaxy S5, that was 5.1 inches, the Sony Xperia Z2, that was 5.2 inches. So we're very much, when it comes to premium phone, 5 inches or bigger.
For more on our smartphone, phablet, tablet, handheld, and any other sort of device that you can imagine, go to theguardian.com/technology. There is a deep irony in the fact that Mario Costella Gonzalez, the Spaniard who won a key legal battle to be forgotten online, was this week one of the easiest names to search. Charles, could you tell us what the European Court of Justice ruling actually said?
What it was really adjudicating was a request by Costella Gonzalez to have links about him removed from Google Search Index, and also to have stories about him which had appeared in the Spanish newspaper, which were then put online by the Spanish newspaper, to have those removed as well. And the European Court of Justice, which is the highest court in Europe, you know, so there's no court of appeal against them. They are the ones who decide, in the final, they're like the US Supreme Court in that sense. They said that the newspaper could keep the articles they had been published, there's a journalist exemption. But in balancing the case of the right to privacy and freedom of expression, they said that the right to privacy won out in this case, and therefore that Google, because it's a data controller, that is, it falls under the Data Protection Directive, it's processing data about people, that Google should have to remove the links from the search index. So you have the interesting situation where the information is still out there on the web, but it becomes more difficult to find it.
That has enormous implications for Google's relevance. If it no longer becomes a whole network, it just simply becomes a partial network of nodes that are allowed. Is this the reason why Google has really been the focus of a lot of the coverage around the right to be forgotten?
Well, it doesn't just affect Google. It affects other search engines which operate in Europe. So it affects Yahoo. It affects Microsoft Bing. I'm not sure whether it affects DuckDuckGo, which is a very small search engine, but which is based in the US. But if you're in effect a sort of a data controller, an aggregator in that way about personal data, then yes, it affects you, but it affects Google because they're absolutely vast in terms of online search in Europe. They've got 95% plus of the search market. So yes, it affects them very directly. And people were going to them, by the hundreds, demanding to have data about them removed. And it's a really interesting case of this collision between the right to privacy and freedom of expression. And what happens if you read the ruling is that they say it has to be balanced. You know, if someone is a public figure, then you don't necessarily remove this information. It may be that there are causes. So, you know, someone who's a sex offender, it may be, this wasn't in the ruling, but it's clear that you would say if someone is a sex offender, then there may be a case to say this data shouldn't be removed. For someone like Chris Huhne, his speeding points, you could say, well, he earned them back in 2003. They should be off the web by now. But because he's a public figure, because he's a cabinet minister, because his speeding points led to him being jailed for perverting the course of justice, therefore all these things will stay. And it's that sort of balance which makes Google very uncomfortable, because it's very difficult to call, and also means that it's an added cost for them of operating in Europe.
How do they intend to adjudicate? This is the search engines in particular, because they suddenly now have to become the judge and jury for this kind of information, don't they? They can no longer pass the agnostic test. Hey, man, we're just putting the data out there.
Well, it's true. They can't say, oh no, we just collect data. We have nothing to do with it. This decision does say you are a data controller. You have responsibilities under the data protection directives. How they're going to do it, they still don't know, and it's very difficult, because this public interest test, the public figure test, is one where you could see that newspapers might say, well, hey, we don't want you taking that out of the index. We think this person's a public figure. And Google then could become caught in a sort of tug of war between the two sides, where someone's saying, take my links out, and the newspaper's saying, no, this person's a public figure, don't take the link out. And so Google could, in effect, be sort of shot by both sides. That doesn't mean that they get out of doing it necessarily. The indications I've had are that they'd very much like it if the data protection authorities, the information commissioner in the UK and all the relevant the sort of equivalents in other countries would do the job for them, would basically adjudicate this. But I think you'll find that the information commissioner will say, sorry, matey, you want to be a data controller, this is part of what comes with the responsibility. You don't get to shove your decisions off onto us. You have to make a decision as the data controller. So I think this is going to be a substantial rise in the costs for Google.
Google's Eric Schmidt, the chairman of the board, has made a comment on this. What was it? What was his response to this?
Well, he said that it was this sort of balance between the rights to privacy and the freedom to know. And he says, we think that they got the balance wrong. It's interesting, because if you sort of dig back through articles that have been written in the past, you find Eric Schmidt has not always been happy about things that have been written about him. He as I understand it, he banned CNET from interviews with him, and this is sort of going back a few years. But they put a whole lot of information they had found on Google about him in some articles, and he was really not very happy about that. There's even a story by Stephen Levy in his book In the Plex, which suggests that Eric Schmidt asked for some information he made about a political donation to be removed from the Google index, and that Sheryl Sandberg, who was then at Google, now at Facebook, told him that was unacceptable. Spokesman for Schmidt has denied that. But there are cases where you can find that he's not been happy with coverage. And, one could argue that, well, he's changed his mind since then. He just thinks that it's much better to have information out there. But clearly, it's something which people sort of feel it's great as a general principle, except when it applies to them.
In fact, he's also allegedly promoted this idea of when you hit the age of 18, you should be able to delete everything about you online. Here we have yet another funny old conflict, and almost an inconsistency between what he's been saying and Google's response to this.
Though to some extent what the ECJ ruling is saying is, why stop at 18? It's that if data about you is irrelevant, outdated or wrong, then the data controller has a responsibility to either remove it or correct it. And American people who have seen this ruling have in general been outraged and said it's just completely stupid. But I think that's a cultural misunderstanding. There's a real gap between Europeans who've seen this ruling and gone, yeah, okay, that fits in with our idea about the privacy of the individual, data protection, that there are some things that actually just don't stick out on the net. And Americans who say First Amendment, freedom of expression, which is you know, I can see where they're coming from on that. Though it's interesting to note that the First Amendment is an amendment. The Constitution talks about life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, though it doesn't have anything about privacy. The argument has been that it'll be the powerful who will seek to do it, that they'll be the ones who'll get their sort of past scrubbed. I think it's not clear about that because there's this public figure element in the ruling. And, you know, maybe it'll be a bit like people getting money back from the banks over, you know, mis-selling of various insurance products. Maybe sort of companies will spring up and say, hey, we'll clean up your past for you. And, you know, would that be a bad thing? Don't know, really. It would be a thing.
It is already a thing in many territories. For more on privacy and the right to be forgotten, go to theguardian.com/technology. Not too dissimilar to the Byzantine workings of the European legal system, we now turn to a world of mazes, puzzles, and hard-to-find doors.
Thomas was alone. Wow, a weird first thought to have.
We're of course talking about the indie hit game Thomas Was Alone, and Keith, you met up with its creator this week. Tell us more.
Yeah, I met up with Mike Bithell. I've actually known Mike for a while. I was one of the first journalists to see Thomas Was Alone a couple of years ago. He developed it alone as a kind of a game design competition for himself. He did a game jam in his own house because his girlfriend was away for the weekend and he didn't know what to do. So he decided to do his own game jam, and he based it around the idea of friendship, and he created this game with a bunch of it's essentially a bunch of shapes trying to escape a computer. They become sentient in some kind of AI era. And he had these shapes which were just placeholder graphics because he wasn't great at coding. He didn't know how to do the graphics properly, and he was going to put in better ones afterwards, but he got a few people to play it and they really liked it just with shapes. So he tells this story about a bunch of shapes that escape this computer. And the game was actually originally released on, it's been out on PC and it's been out on console as well. But now him and a studio called Bossa Studios in London have brought it to iPad. And it's a really, really nice version of the game. It's very intuitive. And it kind of takes me back to rediscovering Thomas Was Alone again, because it's a really lovely game. It's got a really nice story. He has Danny Wallace doing a voiceover for it, and it's Danny Wallace in kind of charming mode. he just works really well. I was very cynical about this working, but he's really good.
And in fact, you asked him about how he got Danny Wallace.
I did, yes. And it's a great Mike Bithell story because it involves lots of charm and serendipity.
Well, then let's hear it.
I'd written the script, and I'd kind of written the script specifically with his tone in mind, because I'm a massive fan of his writing. Me and my girlfriend listen to his audiobooks. We love Danny. So I'd written it with his voice in mind, just as kind of a touchstone, him and kind of a bit of Douglas Adams and a bit of other stuff that I like. So I wrote the script, and then I was trying to find a voice actor to do it. And I realized at a certain point when I was kind of looking at voice actors and listening to people's voice reels and stuff, that I was just trying to find someone who could imitate Danny Wallace. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do that, I might as well give it a go. So I managed to find his email address on some slightly creepy fan site, his personal email address, not his agent or anything, just his personal one. And I just emailed him, and I wrote like a little mini essay about how much I loved his work and why I thought he could work on the game and he'd do a good job. And then I think I included a build of Thomas Was Alone as well, because at that point I was just throwing everything at the email in an attempt to get him. I was a bit tipsy, I believe, at the time as well. And I sent it to him and just assumed that I'd never hear back from him again. That was it, done. And I think it was about 20 minutes later I got yeah, that's great, let's do it.
Wow, 20 minutes.
It was great. I guess he
was tipsy too.
Well, he when he tells the story, and you've got to bear in mind Danny is a professional storyteller, in his version of the story he is also drunk. and he agreed to it when drunk.
Why is he following us? What's that rumbling hungry sound he keeps making? Chris, can we just leave Laura behind?
Huh? But yeah, it's so what I'd not considered is his first job was as a video game critic. So he already knew what video games were. He plays a lot of video games, so he was aware that indie games existed. And when he got Thomas, I guess he saw something in it that he thought he could add to.
Yeah, yeah. And I must say, I'm not a fan of Danny Wallace, but I'm not a particular fan. And okay. I was when I because I played it a little bit earlier, and when I first played the version with him, and I was thinking, is this gonna be? Is this going to affect my understanding of the game? And is there going to be too much Danny Wallace projected onto it because he narrates all the way through the game? Mm. But I think it really does. It really does add an enormous amount to it. I think there's a real kind of wilt to his tone in it that's absolutely perfect for the game.
He's an incredibly talented kind of storyteller. And he was very, very, very respectful to the game. Like, it was not the Danny Wallace show and he didn't treat it as such. I really respected that about him. He came in, he'd been listening on his headphones to the soundtrack on a loop to get his, so he could imagine the music when he was recording, so his voice would fit on top of it. He was, you know, he's a DJ as well, so he worries a lot about this kind of audio stuff too. So I think he really came to it in a really cool way, and it was a pleasure to work with him, and I'm excited to be working with him again. He's very cool.
Yeah, yeah. And music as well is another really important part of the game. Yes. Because I think that lifts the music. I think the narration is part of this, but also the music lifts it into that kind of sphere of drama that a platformer with shapes in might not have reached by itself. Can you tell us a little bit how you met David Housden there?
David, again, very similar kind of story. It was I realized I needed music. I have no musical talent whatsoever. I've never been able to play an instrument. I'm not a great critic of music at all. So I kind of just started looking again for kind of, you know, royalty free music on websites. I assume what most indies do, just trying to find anything that seemed like it might fit. And I couldn't find anything that sounded right to me. So I did what I normally do. I just started complaining, and I tweeted, I think, that I needed music, and I mentioned it to mates down the pub, and I moaned about it at work. And eventually it turned out that one of the guys I worked with is in a band, a guy called AJ Granskrassen, who's now actually doing cool indie stuff himself. We were just kind of chatting about it, and he was like, well, I know a guy who's looking to be a composer. He's just graduated uni and he's looking for a kind of a project, and you probably wouldn't have to pay him. He'll do it on a percentage or something. I was like, fair enough. Okay, he sounds really interesting. Let's chat. So I kind of looked at his stuff, and I've been honest with David, but since I've said, like, I wasn't that impressed. But you know what? He was kind of recommended by a mate, so I got in touch with him, and he produced a kind of a demo, basically, with some footage of Thomas Was Alone playing, and he just put some music over the top of it. And he sent it to me, and I just started crying, actually. I was, like, so moved by it. It was perfect. It was just absolutely incredibly perfect right off the bat. Yeah, he's brilliant. He's very talented. He's annoyingly young. This was his first ever project he'd ever scored. And he's doing really cool work.
There's certain games, yours are one of them, where there is a sense, I think, of community around it. There's a sense of ownership, isn't there, sure, around your game. And it happens with, you know, there's lots of developers who have this sense that they're making games for a community, and they're making games that speak to a community, and that community has access to them. Are you kind of conscious of that? I mean, do you get messages from people that say, you know, Thomas kind of really spoke to me?
I do get it. I do. I definitely have that kind of, those kind of responses. It's weird to me that anyone plays it. Like, I don't think the human mind is designed to be aware that a million people listen to you about something. Like, I don't think that's something that I can't comprehend it. I don't get it. I worry that if I did ever understand it, it would make me into a horrible person. So you know, it's nice. I get lots of messages. This was the first game my kid played, or this is awesome, and this spoke to me, and you know, you made me cry, and all this kind of stuff. And it's wonderful, and it's also massively overwhelming sometimes, of kind of, how is that possible? In terms of how it influences the work, I think I'm more useful as someone who makes stuff if I don't pay attention, to a certain extent, with the kind of the choices I make. If I tied myself up in circles thinking, you know, is this going to serve the Thomas Was Alone audience, that's a very quick and easy way to make really boring games, I think, is to tie it down. I think I have to kind of trust myself that whatever is inside my brain that made me make one thing that people liked, maybe there's the same thing to make the next thing people liked and that kind of stuff.
Mike Bithell there, and to hear the full interview in which Mike discusses not just Thomas Was Alone, but also his journey as a games creator and developer. I had to go into sort of hyper-American, journey. Sort of Dom DeLuca, you know, the great voiceover artist. His journey as a games creator and developer. And also the vibrancy of the indie game scene. That's at soundcloud.com/GuardianTechWeekly. We'll have the links on the blog for the show. A huge thanks to Keith and, of course, all of the tech team. Sam and Charles. Tech Weekly is produced by Jason Phipps. I'm Alex Kratosky, and we will have more for you next week. Thank you for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.